nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So today I'd like to talk about something a little different from what we've been doing. And I guess the broad topic is the semi-classical dynamics. Now, what do I mean by that is, well, see, so far what we've been talking about generally is semi-classical transport, right? So what's semi-classical dynamics? What do we mean by that? Okay. So if you think back on what we were talking about, there's these electrons coming in from one end and go off to the other end. And I said that you could describe it in semi-classical picture with an equation like this. Now, the point I'd like to make, and this I think will come up often as we talk about current flow in general, and that is that current flow always involves these two types of things, which are really very different. One is what you might call dynamics, and the other is more like what you might call thermodynamics, the part that has to do with exchange of heat and energy with the surroundings. And the dynamics is where essentially energy is constant, and you go from one point to another, obeying what you might call Newton's law, quote unquote. So, for example, if you had no scattering processes in this at all, then this term would be out. You wouldn't have any forces that take positive going things and turn them around, so you wouldn't have that. And the rest of it, if you solved it, that's ballistic transport. So here what is happening then is electrons go ballistically from one point to another. So the dynamics of the electrons would be purely ballistic, going from one to the other. And then at the ends, of course, as I've mentioned, there are complicated processes that relax the energy. And that kind of has to be there. It has to be part of it. There has to be energy relaxation eventually because, after all, anytime current flows, heat is dissipated. This is I times V or I squared R. And that has to happen sometime. But with the small devices, the nice thing, as I said, conceptually is that the dynamics is separated from the rest. So what I'm talking about today is more is about this dynamics part of it. Right? And this is the part where you can get more sophisticated and include quantum mechanics, which would be like a quantum dynamics. But you see, you still have to include all this energy relaxation and what happens in the context and things like that. What you're really replacing is just the Newtonian part with quantum mechanics, for example. Now, what I'll talk about today is semi-classical dynamics. Well, you'll say, well, what's there to talk about here? It's possibly just like Newton's law, right? So Newton's law, as you know, is something like, I'll write it here, dx dt, and the rate at which the position changes is equal to velocity, and the rate at which the momentum changes, that's equal to the force, you know, which could be, for a charged particle, it would be Q times the electric field. Right? So that would, now, of course, this is what describes just a free electron in vacuum. And then you would have P equals mv, where m is the mass of an electron. Now, what we are talking about, of course, even in a ballistic conductor, is not a free electron in vacuum. It's about an electron that is moving through a crystal, a very complicated solid. And one of the very important results, one of the very important insights that arose back in the, I guess I'd say 1930s and 40s, you know, first right after the development of quantum mechanics, was this insight that electrons in a complicated solid behave or move, the dynamics is as if they were going through vacuum, but with a slightly different mass. That's this effective mass. Now, in general, though, it isn't quite as simple as that. It's not like you can take it like if, as if it's in vacuum and just change the mass. It's a little more than that because, as you know, in a solid, people have something called this, what they call band structure. They calculate this EK relations. E versus K. And in vacuum, this E versus K is supposed to look like, you know, E is equal to p squared over 2m, and which is like h bar square k squared over 2m in vacuum. And so E versus K in vacuum, expect it to look like a parabola, like so. Now, in a solid, after you have solved this very complicated problem with a periodic potential due to the atoms and lattice and all that, you come out with an EK relationship that doesn't really look like this. That looks actually a whole lot more complicated. You know, a typical picture might look something like that. Valence band, conduction band, all kinds of stuff. But then if you're really interested just in electrons around here, then you could replace it with a little parabola, you know, that fits the real one over a small energy range. And then say, well, to fit that parabola, of course, the usual mass won't do. I'll have to use something else. So whatever it is, we'll use that and go on. So it's a very approximate thing, of course. I mean, in general, you could have any EK relation. And one very current example that a lot of people are talking about, have an interest in, is graphene, where E versus K actually looks, you know, linear right around there. It doesn't even look like a parabola. It looks like a straight line. Okay. So the question is then, what would be the dynamics of something like that? That is, it wouldn't be quite Newton's law, but what we are talking about still is semi-classical dynamics. What that means is, yeah, that's what I'll try to explain, I guess, a little bit. And what would be the semi-classical dynamics in an arbitrary EK relation? In a solid with any EK relation, what would be the dynamics? Okay? And as I said, if it's a parabola, then it's just like Newton's law. You just change the mass and you're done. But it need not be a parabola. It could be something more complicated. Okay. Now, as I said, the Newton's law looks like this. Now, there's a more general version of this, or more widely, not sure if I'd call it more general, but an alternative way of writing this, which actually is widely applied, that's called the Hamilton's form. Now, the way that one looks is the following. It goes as, write it as dx dt is equal to del E del P. And dp dt is equal to minus del E del X. So the idea is, in this way of thinking about it, you first start out by writing the energy as a function of X and P. X being position, P being the momentum. And so you'd have something like E equals P squared over 2m, that's like the kinetic energy, and something that you'd call the potential energy. That's it. So in general, you'd add something like that to it. And I guess you'd have to add that here too. Anyway. And so E is now a function of two things, X and P. So when I take the partial of E with respect to P, that means I hold x constant, take the derivative with respect to p. So what would you get in this case? What is partial of E with respect to p? Just p over m. So that's velocity. You'd say, okay, that's p over m. Okay. So velocity is that. And dp dt, that's partial of E with respect to x. And now I hold p constant, so this is as if like a constant. Like, I mean, when I take the derivative, it just gives me 0. And so del E del X is just del U del X. So this is equal to, so which is like the gradient of the potential energy. And that's the force, as you know. Force would be the gradient of the potential energy. So you see, you're getting back something that looks just like Newton's law. Dx dt equals velocity and this. Okay. Now the thing is that when we get to quantum mechanics, then this p is replaced by h bar k, you know. So when you write Schrodinger equation, usually the rule is start from here, turn the E into I h bar d dt is equal to, and instead of P, you write minus I h bar d dx. So this whole thing acting on psi. That's the Schrodinger equation as you've seen. Right? So this you write as minus h bar squared over 2m del 2 del x2. That would be Schrodinger equation. And the general rule for getting from here to here is E becomes I h bar d dt and P becomes minus I h bar d dx. Right? And you could generalize this to three dimensions. I'm just trying to keep it simple so you see the basic things. Three dimensions means just as you have an x, there would be a y and z. And there are the vector ways of writing it a little more compactly, etc. But essentially, this is what we are talking about. Okay. Now, if you did not have any potential here, question is, what would the solution to this Schrodinger equation be? If, say, you didn't have any potential energy, or it was just a constant, let's say. Let's say, yeah, in fact, let's not drop it, we'll keep it as a constant. So one of the things I always say is that anytime you have a differential equation with constant coefficients, the solution can be written in the form of exponentials. And it got nothing to do with quantum mechanics, just a mathematical thing about differential equations. So you could write the solution to this in the form of psi is equal to e to the power ikx. E to the power minus I e t over h bar e to the power I k x. So this you can check easily, you know, with differential equations, as I often mention that, you know, it's looking at a differential equation, you may not right away know the solution, but if someone claims that this is a solution, you can easily substitute it and check. And of course, with exponentials, the nice thing is taking derivatives is very easy. You can check it very quickly. This will work. And the thing you can convince yourself is this will work provided E is equal to h bar square k square over 2m plus, remember, I assume the u to be a constant, plus u0. So as long as this E here and this K here are related by that relationship, this solution will satisfy Schrodinger equation. That you can check. Okay. Now, what if this were not a constant but were varying with X? Then the answer is, in general, you have to solve the differential equation. There's no simple way to write it. You know, like the hydrogen atom, there you have this U that's due to the nucleus, you know, very large potential at attractive potential. And you have to solve the Schrodinger equation for the hydrogen atom, a whole different issue. But then if this U is slowly varying, then the solution that works approximately is something like this, where this E is fixed, but as if the K just changes slowly as you go along. Such that at every point x, this relationship is satisfied. Of course, the E is fixed. The thing is, as long as in this differential equation nothing is changing with time, I can write the time part of the solution this way. But since it's varying with x, in general, I wouldn't be able to write the x part easily. But what I'm claiming is you could write it as with a varying k. So which would actually be, instead of ikx, you'd then write something like integral dx prime kx prime. You'd have to. So it is sort of like, if you're thinking in terms of time, it would be like a frequency modulated signal. You know, so where the frequency just keeps changing slowly. Here it's like the k is changing slowly. It ends as you go along. Okay. And the E's and K's would be related by this equation. And since E is constant, if U changes, clearly K must also change. That must also be a function of X when you write a solution of this sort in order to work. So the picture people have in mind here is something like this. that, let's say I plot u, so along x, u, let's say, is going down. That would correspond to a force acting in this direction, because u is going down, which means its derivative is negative, and force is the negative derivative of u, so force is positive. That's so at any u, I could draw E versus K, and it would look, say, something like this. Somewhere here, I could draw a little EK diagram. Somewhere here, I could draw another EK diagram as I go along. And the question you could ask is, well, if an electron were initially somewhere here in a state like this, then as it goes along, how will its K increase? And the answer is, of course, the total energy remains the same. So from here, when it goes on here, the K will have increased from this much to that much. All that happens is your E stays the same. The total energy stays the same. But you can see, as a result, the K will increase. And according, you'd say, well, it's just like Newton's law. Because of a force, the momentum increased. Okay? But basically, that's it. And you could show, then, that the increase in K would actually follow what you'd have expected from this kind of an equation. Let me show that. So first thing is that how do I know that this would obey, you know, this wave, this Schrodinger, a wave described by Schrodinger equation would roughly obey what I expect from Newton's law? And the idea is that, well, the way people think about this is, if I create a little wave packet like this in x, so let's say at t equals 0, the wave function looks something like this. Now, a wave function like this is not just e to the power I k x, but it is something with quite a few k's in it, because e to the power I k x would be all over the place. You'd have to take a few of these and put them together to form a localized wave packet. And what you can show is a localized wave packet like this in time would move with this group velocity that you have read somewhere in freshman physics. And that group velocity is given by d omega dk, as you know, in general, which in this context would be 1 over h bar dE dk. So any wave packet from Schrodinger equation, you'd think, would move according to dx dt. That's the velocity. Will move according to 1 over h bar dE dk. And that, you can see, is looking like Hamilton's equation. You know, this was meant for particles. And what we are trying to, what I'm trying to say is that if you use Schrodinger equation and think of a slowly varying potential, then a wave packet would move almost like that particle, the particle for which this is supposed to be the wave, corresponding wave. Now, what about dk dt? How do I find this? And as I said, physically the issue is that if I create a wave packet somewhere here, it moves along. And as it moves along, the energy stays the same, and so the k has to increase. And what I want to show is that the rate at which k will increase will basically be like this minus del E del X. The answer will be 1 over h bar del E del X. But this I want to show quickly why you'd expect that. Now, the way this would work is the following. So mathematically, the way you can show it is that you see dE dt is equal to 0. So here is E, which is a function of x and k, and the rate at which it changes with time is 0. And with time, what is changing is it's x and k. The electron has started at some x and some k. As it goes along, the x position has changed and the k is also changing. But in such a way that the overall thing isn't changing. So this rate of change of E with time, you could write separately as del E del X times dx dt plus del E del K times dk dt. Because E is a function of X and K, and those are the two things that are changing. And that has to be 0. Now, the thing is that this is velocity, of course, dx dt by definition. And what is this? Del E del K? That is h bar times the velocity. Anyway, so the whole thing then kind of becomes like V times del E del X plus h bar dk dt. So what that means is, of course, and that has to be equal to 0. So what that tells you is that dk dt must be 1 over h bar del E del X with a negative sign. So that's this. Okay. So now the thing is that in a general solid, you know, with some arbitrary EK relationship, the point is these equations are correct. Now, what might happen is, of course, when I take the velocity, usually what happens is this becomes something like h bar k over m if E depends on k according to this parabolic relation. In a general EK relationship, this may not be anything as simple. It could look something very different. And so you might say that the velocity is not h bar k over m, but has some strange form. But the second equation, in terms of k, still works. It's still dk dt is equal to this. But if you were trying to use Newton's law and call this mv dt, you know, because this is like momentum, I guess I should include the h bar here. H bar k would be like momentum. Then this wouldn't be true. I mean, you wouldn't know what to use for mass, for example, really. But as long as you don't do this, as long as you stick to this, you're fine. This is it. For general, any arbitrary EK relationship, whatever it is, these are the basic equations of motion in 1D, but you can easily generalize it to 3D. So in 3D, it would have looked something like this. What happens is dx dt, so I'm putting a vector on top of that. Implication is it's like x, y, and z, you know, whatever spatial coordinates you're interested in. So that's dx dt. So it'll be like dx dt equals 1 over h bar del E del kx. Dy dt del E del ky and del E del kz. And the general kind of vector notation for writing that would be 1 over h bar grad of E. But usually, of course, the gradient operator is in real space. So when you see a grad operator, it means ddx in the x direction, ddy, etc. But here, what I really mean is grad with respect to k. So the x component of that vector is del E del kx. Y component of that vector is del E del ky, etc. So that's the grad k. And similarly, this one then becomes dk dt is equal to minus 1 over h bar grad E. And this one is the usual grad. It's in real space. Del E del X, del E del Y, del E del Z, etc. So this would be the vector version of what we say. So these would then be the general equations of motion for any EK relationship. Okay. So for example, let's say you have a material in which you have some strange EK relationship, so that, you see, when I'm trying to visualize it, it's often useful to draw what is called a constant energy contour. So if E were equal to, say, h bar square k square over 2m, and we're doing this in two dimensions, so k square means say, kx square plus ky square. If you had, say, something like this, then can you help me with what the constant energy contour would look like? Circle. Right? It'll look like this. So on any point on this circle, you could ask then, what will the velocity look like at any point? Now, it's supposed to be the grad of E with respect to K. So what is the direction of that? Now, what I claim is in some that that actually looks like at any point, it is perpendicular like this. Now, wherever you go, perpendicular. And the way you can kind of see this is, I guess if you're familiar with, say, electrostatic fields, as you know, in electrostatic fields, you write E, electric field, as the gradient of the potential, actually with a negative sign. So as you know, electric field is perpendicular to the equipotential surfaces. Now, of course, what we are talking about here has no physical relationship to this. It's just that it's mathematically similar. So if you have once invested the time to understand why this electric field happens to be perpendicular to the equipotential surfaces, you can immediately see why this velocity must be perpendicular to the equi-energy surfaces, because it's mathematically much the same thing, although physically we are talking of two different things. Because in all of this, as you know, this takes time to translate the math to a particular physical situation. And once you have understood some math, it's always good if you can use it in different places. Okay. So the point is here then, in general, velocity will want to be perpendicular. And so for a circular thing like this, when it's isotropic, the velocity is actually collinear with K. Collinear meaning, you know, V is in the same direction as K. And as you know, in general, what would happen here is you'd get velocity equal to h bar K over M. That's what you'd end up with in this case. So V is exactly in the same direction as K. What that means is when you have dH bar K dt, you could just write dmv dt, you're done, whatever that M happens to be. But supposing you had a material where, let's say, the equi-energy contours look something like this. So in this, now for the valence band, actually, in some cases, I mean, it doesn't quite look like a square, but something that you could approximate, something like this. So what that means is that the velocity would look like, on this line, it would look like this. Here, it would look like that. Etc. So what that would mean is, now supposing in a material like this we put an electric field. So my question is, how does the electron move in semi-classical dynamics? Well, how does it move in K space? Well, that's given by this equation. dK dt is proportional to the electric field. You know, gradient of the energy, that's electric field. So if you put an electric field in a particular direction, let's say at 30 degrees to the x-axis, then the electron should move in K space like so, in the direction of the electric field, in K space. How does it move in real space? Well, we have to now go on to the, let's draw the picture in X and Y. So how does it move in real space? Any thoughts? Yeah. So that's where you are back to this first equation. dx dt is this grad with respect to K. And that, as you see, is in the x direction if you are anywhere in this quad, in this part. So it should be moving like that in the x direction. So you see, we are going considerably beyond Newton's law. See, when you are talking of these things, right? It's kind of counterintuitive. And it is not as if dmv dt is proportional to the force. It's just that dk dt is proportional to the force. So when you have applied an electric field, it's just dk dt is this one. Yeah, please. Right now, don't quite recall a simple functional form that would get you this. But, you know, you could always say that E is equal to, let's say, just depends on Kx. So E, let's say, is equal to alpha Kx, Kx, let's say. So that would give you energy that only depends on your Kx and is independent of Ky. Yeah, so whatever the ky, what that means is energy is the same everywhere around here. In that area. And then for this part, you could write. So you could write an artificial thing like this to describe this. And this is, of course, an idealized thing. But in the valence band, as I said, there are, you know, some of the valence bands actually have EK diagrams looking like that. You'll see pictures like this often in books. Where what I mean is the constant energy contours looking like that. You do get things like that. But this was mainly to illustrate a point that K and V do not need to be collinear. You could have a K like this in some direction of this, or, and the V could be somewhere pointing in some other direction in general. Although if it is isotropic, all the directions are the same, then you tend to have circles here, in which case the normal at any point is also collinear with the radius. And so K and V are collinear. That is true. This one, dx dt is equal to 1 over h bar grad k. And this, from a wave point of view, if I were to justify it, I would say this is like d omega dk. So this thing you learn in freshman physics, that wave packets move with a group velocity given by d omega dk. So that's not an obvious thing or anything, but I didn't quite go into that in any detail. I just stated it. So dx dt is that. And then the point I made is that grad of E with respect to k, this vector points in the direction that's normal to the equi-energy surface. So whatever the equi-energy surface, it will always be perpendicular to that. Now, one interesting thing is that this perpendicular, you might ask, well, should it be the outward normal? Why did I draw it as outward normal and not the inward normal, for example? Is it outward or inward? And again, the answer is just this, it is whether the energy is increasing or decreasing. When you increase K, does the energy increase or decrease? And this is where, again, you can see that the answer will be different depending on whether we are talking about a conduction band or a valence band. What I mean by that is, if your EK relation looks like this, anywhere here, if I increase K, I increase the energy also. Anywhere here, if I increase K, I actually go down in energy. So in a valence band, actually the group velocity is opposite to the K. See? And so one question that sometimes comes up, we talked about the Hall effect or things like that. One of the very important facts about the Hall effect is that in semiconductors, depending on whether it's N-type semiconductor or P-type semiconductor, the Hall effect reverses sign. So now there's a Hall voltage would actually turn wrong. And the question is why? Why is that? And often people say, well, it's actually because in a valence band you have holes. Now, that I have never liked very much as an argument because, you know, holes, the way you usually learn it is that, you know, basically it's all electrons. It's just that in the valence band, because there are all these are filled, and there's only a few holes, it is conceptually convenient to think in terms of holes rather than electrons. That's what you're usually told. Now, the thing is that the sign of an experimentally observed effect should not depend on what you and I find conceptually convenient. That's the thing. So I could easily argue that, you know, I prefer to think in terms of electrons. I don't really want to get into holes at all. You see, and I should be able to do everything fine. There should be really no problems at all. But the fact, of course, experimental fact is that Hall voltage for this is different from that. And if you ask me why, it's basically, I'd say, because here V and K are collinear, here V and K are pointing in the opposite direction. So that's the essential point, which you could call almost a negative mass in a way. Because if you think of V as being H bar K over M, then if those two guys are pointing in opposite directions, you'd conclude that M is something like negative. So I'd say that's the essential difference really between this band and that band. Not that whether it's filled or half filled or what. That's not the issue really. Okay. Yes. So if I had put an electric field, not at 30 degrees, but at say 60 degrees, then you would always be on this side, and then your real space motion would be in this direction, right? Whereas because I said it is, for this particular idealized thing I have drawn, it's like anybody whose k is less than 45 degrees moves x, anybody whose k is more than 45 degrees moves y. That's what I said. Now, this Hall effect, though, one thing that complicates it also, the dynamics itself. You know, I'd said, of course, when we were discussing this, that the basic thing is just that an electron wants to keep turning. That is, in K space, I think we had this Kz and Kx, any electron kind of always wants to be going around in a circle like this. And in a magnetic field, basically, it just keeps wanting to turn. And the rate at which it wants to turn, that's what you call the cyclotron frequency, omega c. And omega c for parabolic bands is qb over m. And so, again, it's a standard way of measuring mass, for example, all of this. Okay. Now, the proper description of this, what happens in a magnetic field, and of course, here we are even just talking of small magnetic fields, not necessarily worrying about what happens in big magnetic fields either. But in small it requires it's a little more complicated than what I just described. And reason is that you see what I told you was that E is equal to H bar square K square over 2m. And then if you want to add a potential, like a potential energy, you could write just QV. Or this is what I wrote as U. So Q is the charge on an electron. V is the potential, the scalar potential. And the gradient of V is this electric field. Right? So the way you usually think is electric field is equal to negative grad V. And charge on an electron is negative, so that's why positive potentials usually give you negative potential energy and so on. Okay. So I said, well, this is easy enough. And so in Schrodinger equation, you just add it there. And as I said, if this was constant, it would be trivial. If it is slowly varying, then you could do something approximate like we said. Okay. Now the question is, how do you include a magnetic field in this? And there the thing is, in general, magnetic fields cannot be written in terms of a scalar potential. You have to write it as in terms of a vector potential. So let me just write this here. So just as electric field is the scalar potential, B is this vector potential. Vector potential A. And the way the vector potential enters this equation is a little more complicated, and that is just as the scalar potential was as if you took the E and subtracted QV from it, the vector potential is like as if you take the H bar K and subtract QA from it. So the correct one looks something like this. H bar K minus QA squared. What that means is if you're thinking of these as vectors, it's like this vector dotted with itself. So that's what it looks like. See? So in order to include a magnetic field into this description, in general, with Schrodinger equation, etc., you'd have to change this h bar k into h bar k minus qa square divided by 2m. So this is what it would be for a typical parabolic thing. Now, so question is, what's dx dt? Of course, these equations are still fine, by the way. We don't need to change anything here. Dx dt is this, dk dt is that. There's no problem with that. This is still fine. Okay. So first question is, what is the velocity of an electron here? So let's try to find dx dt. And for the moment, let's say you're always, there's one more thing I need to mention before we go on, and that is that for a given magnetic field, of course, just as here, for an electric field, the V has to be changing with distance, because if you have an electric field in the x direction, then V should be changing in the x direction. Now, with this B, the problem is, it isn't quite so simple. It's not like if the B is in the y direction, A will change in the y direction, because this curl is a little more complicated than that one. Okay? So let me just explain what that looks like. It works something like this. So I think the coordinate system we had used was, this is z, this is x, and the B was in the y direction. So that would be like, suppose, coming out of the blackboard. So it's a BY. Now my question is, what's the corresponding vector potential? And the answer would be, B is curl of A. So this BY is the Y component of the curl of A, okay? Which would be like del AZ del X minus del AX del Z. So in order to represent a magnetic field that points in the y direction, I could either write a AZ that changes with x. Did I get this right? Or I think the sign is reversed, but it's a minor point. But because I think the way you do this, the DDZ, I think, should come first. Turn this around. So you could write AX is equal to BY times Z, and that would work. So that would be one way to choose your vector potential to give you a magnetic field in the Y direction. Another way to choose it would have been to say AZ is equal to minus BY times X. That's another way to do it. And in general, of course, you could take any linear combination of the two and it would still work. So you could take, say, alpha times this and 1 minus alpha times that, where alpha is any number, essentially. Because you evaluate del AX, del Z, del AZ, del X, do this, you'll get BY, no matter what. And so there is a little arbitrariness. Of course, even with scalar potentials, as you know, there's a little arbitrariness. Given an electric field, you can always add a constant. It's still the same electric field. But here also, there is this little arbitrariness. And in general, of course, what happens usually, except for some very special things, that how you choose all this shouldn't matter. That is, whatever alpha I choose, it shouldn't affect any physical answers. So for example, if at the end of the day we are talking of what is the cyclotron frequency, omega c is qb over m, the thing is that answer should not depend on what alpha I choose here. Because then I got problems, because this alpha is almost arbitrary. You could choose anything you want, and you're still describing the same physical problem. Okay. Now, my question is then, here, if I'm trying to write dx dt, that's the velocity in the x direction, or dz dt, any of those. My question is, what do we get, given that this is still the correct answer? This is still fine. can you help me with what the dx dt should be? It's the gradient with respect of E with respect to K. Right? So if I'm doing dx dt, I should say gradient with respect to kx. Okay? So actually, let me just write this out in terms of its components. And for this discussion, we don't need a scalar potential. So let me just write it all out. So that way you'll see it clearly. And I'm not even writing the y component because we won't be using it. So just the x and z. So dx dt is how much? You have to take the derivative with respect to kx. So what do we get? H bar kx minus qax over 2m. Over m actually. That's it. And the same with dz dt, etc. So you could actually generalize this to the vector notation. Dx dt is h bar k minus qa over m. This would be the general thing. If you want x component, y component, z component. So you notice there's already a little bit of a problem in the sense that for simple parabolic bands, we're not even talking of anything complicated. Simple parabolic bands, dx dt is not quite h bar k over m, but there's this qa that came in. Yeah? And so when discussing electrons in a magnetic field with a vector potential, it's convenient to actually call this, whatever it is, k minus qa, call that a k prime of some kind. And that is kind of what plays the role of the ordinary k. So then you can say, okay, yeah, velocity is like a slightly different k, but that's divided by m, that's what the velocity is. Okay. Now, if you want to do the other one, the dk dt, that's when you get to something interesting, a little different. So how do we write dk dt? Can you help me? In fact, let's do dkx first. Again, same basic formula. In fact, let me put the h bar here. So h bar dkx dt is negative grad of the energy. So if I'm trying to write x, I need to take gradient of E with respect to x. So what should we get? Can you help me? I'm trying to take the gradient with respect to x. So what is it here that depends on x? Az. Note that Ax doesn't depend on x, no matter how I choose things. It's the Az that depends on x, right? So for this discussion, this thing is almost constant. Ignore. This is the thing. So when you do that, what you'll get is h bar kz minus qaz over m, and then times q del az del x. And this is like Vz. Because we agreed that velocity is like h bar k minus qa over m. So if you look at this, it kind of looks promising, but not quite right. Promising in the sense that, h bar dk dt should be equal to the force. That's this Newton's law. And of course, force that you know in a magnetic field is V cross B. That's Lorentz force. So what you're hoping to get is a V cross B at the end of it. Now, are we getting there? Well, dkx dt, V cross B. So I should have got something like Vz times By. That would be like the x component of V cross B. And I'm getting something that looks like Vz. This isn't quite By, because it's except for, because there's a little arbitrariness. Of course, I could choose my alpha to make this By, but then it's not like holds for any old alpha. Okay? So you can see that it's kind of getting there, but it's a little different. Now, the important thing is that actually, if you work in, we're kind of out of time, so I'll finish this up next year. But the thing is, and in that homework two, all the summary that we have in the first three pages. At the end of the three pages, the last thing is this dynamics, the algebra of this. So the algebra of that is right there. So you can look at exactly how you get there. But anyway, the bottom line is that h bar dk dt, you think should be q v cross b. And that's true, except that it's not the dk dt, but dk prime dt, that's this. K prime meaning this guy. If you do dk dt, it will be kind of right, but not quite. And what you get will depend on alpha and all that. But finally, if you look at dk prime dt, then the answer will be q v cross b, independent of what alpha you choose. Okay. And so the semi-classical equations of motion in a magnetic field would look something like this. But one thing I want to stress is, again, that basically it is still these equations. I didn't add anything new there. It is just that to get from here to here, you have to do some algebra, starting from whatever EK. And if you had some strange EK you want to start from, you know, like for the homework problem, I asked you to do it for graphene. You know, for graphene, this is linear. It looks a little different. Well, you still start from the same place, of course. But then when you work through, you'll get something a little different, but something like this. That's the point. So let me stop here today and we'll finish this.